You are listening to Red Lion Readings, which is recorded live at Civic Theatre Tala as part of South Dublin Library's Red Lion Book Festival Readers' Day. On this programme, you will hear Dermot Bulger in conversation with Adrian Kenny. We are joining Dermot at the Civic Theatre as he introduces Adrian to the audience. Red Lion Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland fund.
There's different people I've always wanted to invite to Readers' Day, and there are people who are quiet heroes of mine, and one of them is the writer Adrian Kenny, who was born in Dublin in 1945, and who's done a magnificent memoir called The Family Business that was a fantastic examination of growing up in Dublin, of sort of the intricacies of family life, and it was lived in Portobello in Dublin for 30 years, and this year, celebrate that with this absolutely exquisite book by Lilliput Press, and although it's a work of fiction, in a sense, it's a set of linked short stories, that it is really like almost like, a memoir in some extent? It's a memoir through fiction of different moments of his life, and he's somebody who is neglected hero of Irish writing, and very, very respected, but it's still sort of, I think that this book deserves a huge audience, and so I'm going to ask Adrian to read one of his stories. Adrian, Enormous Expense and Direct from Portobello, Adrian Kenny. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. I'm going to read a short story. These 12 stories are autobiographical, but they're turned into fiction to make it easier to write and to understand. This one is called Saturday Evening Mass. As his mother grew old, she went out less often. She took a taxi to the doctor, the hairdresser, the chiropodist. On Saturday evenings, he drove her to Mass. When he had told her, 25 years ago, that he no longer went to Mass, she had cried, as she had cried when her own mother was dying, helpless tears. Now she accepted it as a cranky form of independence, as she accepted her swollen knuckles, living alone, or the tablets she had to take for her heart. He reached into the back seat for the rug, the old plaid they had used to sit on at picnics, and she laid it on her knees. She noticed a darn in it, and he explained that his wife had mended a tear their children had made. She rubbed the darn with the backs of her fingers, making it woolly so it blended with the rest, and said her mother had taught her that. What once might have bored or irritated him brought peaceful, warm conversation now. Since her husband had died, she had found her own little ways of independence. She didn't go out because she didn't want to. She wore what was comfortable, a man's quilted green jacket over her cardigan this evening, and a threadbare bit of silk to hide her withered neck. Once so timid and genteel, a countrywoman, uneasy in this bourgeois suburb, now she spoke her mind more easily, said what was spontaneous. Look, she nodded at the two old bachelor brothers out walking their Scotty dog. Look at them talking. You'd think they hadn't met for years. The heavenly twins, he said, and she laughed. He drove down the wide road between the lime and chestnut trees, turned right at the traffic lights. She looked in the gourmet grocery shop window at the checkout girls. Can you see Pauline? There, at the end. I see her, the blonde mop. We'll stop on the way home. Remind me to get the guide. Her routine of mass and shopping no longer smothered him. Approaching death had set it in a wider frame. He drove under the Blackstone Railway Bridge, turned right again up the narrow road of red brick houses, between cars parked, bonnet to booth on either side. He had to stop in the middle of the road. I'll be back in an hour. Do you know what you could do? Go up to the park and get me a few sticks for the fire. I love the smell of them. She folded the rug and put it in the back seat, and she put her feet out awkwardly on the road, muttering, I'm like a giraffe. The way she walked slowly to the porch, dipped her bent fingers in the holy water and blessed herself, made even the big, crude granite church seem beautiful. It made him want to park the car and follow her inside. But he had tried that and found it still led back to the enclosed world he had escaped. He had to forage for scraps outside. He took shortcuts up the familiar old roads, past the park, that cranky Independence, down to where the river flowed between a playing field and a steep wooded slope. The smell of half-dead water and the damp, sandy clay brought memories. As he walked upstream, he remembered the children from the flats swimming in their mother's saggy bloomers in the summertime. A day he and his brother had invited them home, and his vague, uneasy feeling that something was wrong as the children had trooped upstairs. He stood to watch a heron in the shallows. The memories flowed past like the river. He looked at the heron's grey shoulders and yellow-streaked breast, the water sliding by its long, pale brown legs, the purplish alder and light green willow trees reflected in the surface, all as still as the pale blue evening sky. It was like a glass pane. On the other side, in death, he would be there. He felt no fear, instead a peaceful joy. Breathing in the feeling, reverent as his mother returning from communion, he walked back slowly to his car. There was a cheer from the playing field. A soccer match had ended. Two teams of middle-aged men were making for the ship's container used as a changing room. The few people along the touch lines were straggling away. He glanced at one of them, head hunched, hands cupped, taking a light for a cigarette from another. He hesitated, but then Tom glanced up and saw him, and he crossed the rough, wet grass. "Tom, where did you spring from?" It came out wrong, the wrong tone in his voice. Quickly he held out his hand. "I saw you passing. I was thinking it was you." Deliberately, slowly, Tom put his cigarette between his lips, then shook hands. His face opened. Then it was cold again. He turned to a man beside him and said, "I'll see you." And the man walked away. A long time. He got the sweet smell of beer from Tom's breath. "Where have you been?" "Thailand. Did I not send you a card?" "When did you get back?" "There a few months ago." "And where are you staying?" Already he was watchful. "In a hostel." He didn't reply. Tom picked up his unease, and as if well used to that, he withdrew into silence. Together they walked down to the river and stood looking at its silent, swift flow. An electric blue flash, a kingfisher, flew upstream. "You always see something if you stand still." "I do plenty of that." His monster accent rippled through the standard tone. How had he become a drifter? How had someone with the pick of beautiful girls when he was young ended up alone? At a distance, he knew the answer. At odds with his father, Tom had left home as a boy, and now his parents were dead. He drifted like the twigs and leaves on the river. It was still in his face, the unforgiving look of someone who had known narrow country ways. But as always, when he was with him, that answer failed. It was more than that. Tom was as determined in his own way as he. Drifted, maybe, but so had the bog water, trickles and mountain streams that formed this river. He was a man in his own right. "Which way are you going?" "I have to collect my mother from Mass. Have you time for a drink?" Tensed like a cat, ready to go at the first hint. "Just a quick one." He looked at the thin yellow face, the dark hollows under his eyes, the thin-rimmed glasses, the grey hair sleeked and slightly too long at the back, the beautiful hands. His fingertips moved all the time against his thumbs, as if cleaning them. The sleeves of his jacket were too long. They walked together up to the road, then down to join the river bank again. In the calm, taut water above the fall, a cormorant surfaced. Its bill tilted like a bayonet, its black back shining like oil. "Look at him. I saw him earlier with an eel as big as himself. I bet you it didn't get away." Tom smiled. "It didn't. Do you ever see any of the old crowd now?" "Strange. I ran into Terry Hunt. He asked me to dinner. I heard he was home. Nice place. I never got there. He had some appointment." Watching the cormorant sail high in the water, Tom added that smile again. "We had a burger in McDonald's." He led, and Tom followed without question down the path to the foot of the fall, where they watched the foaming water settle and run smooth. "What's the hostel like?" "Okay, you have your own room." "No girlfriend?" "Here, are you joking? Any jobs coming up?" "I don't want one. I'm tired of it." Tom's eyes fixed on the river, following its flow down to a bed of gravel where it broke into rough white again. He knew that life. He had tasted it once when they had worked together abroad. The novelment, excitement, energy, endless as the river. Teaching English all day, drinking and talking all night, art, politics, religion, sex, until his throat was raw. He had come home refreshed. Tom had gone on. Bahrain, Bangkok, always further east. He had rung late one night a few years ago, drunk. "I'm in bed with a beautiful girl. Her name's Nag. Do you want to talk to her?" There was rustling, sighing, and then a sleepy girl's voice had said, "Hello." Since then there had been silence. "And what'll you do?" Tom shrugged. In his silence he could hear the cry, "Take me home." They stood to watch the cormorant bob past on the fast water and vanish under the bridge. Together they walked along the path to the pub's car park. Tom led the way inside as easy as the cormorant in the river and as alert. He glanced down the counter, saw the man he had been with at the football match and coldly turned away. "What'll you have?" "Just a glass." "That'll only bother you." Tom called for 2 pints. His beer went down as always in 6 swallows. "Why not do one last stint abroad? A few years in Saudi. You'd have enough for the deposit on a flat." "I can't stand Saudi." "Were you there? You didn't save?" "I used to go to Thailand for the holidays." The line, deep as a wheel on either side of his mouth, tightened about his smile. Aloneness surrounded him like the static light when you pull off a shirt in the dark. So long he'd been doing it, so long. The drive always longer than expected from the airport to the new school. The bare, newly cleaned apartment, the first night drink, then the first classes, the front row pupils well-reared and ambitious, the troublemaker sat in the middle yawning, the slow one sat at the back smiling and hiding from the light. The weak were nice, the strong were not. Life was so simple, a child could understand it. Then suddenly it was the end of term, parties, students queuing to take his photo and ask for his address, and never writing, and the faces he had grown used to fading, and in a month forgotten. And then Tom was home to Ireland where he had no home, which drove him abroad again. He glanced at his watch as he raised his glass, preparing his escape. Tom saw the look and reached into his pocket again. "One more." He stood an inch too close. He could feel his loneliness, like the chill when you open a fridge door. "I can't, Tom. My mother will be waiting." "Won't she be lighting candles for a while?" "Here." He put some money on the counter. As he left, he saw the man at the end of the counter glide down to sit beside Tom. His guilt cleared. He knew they would be there till closing time. Who cared about art, politics, religion, sex? Any talk would do, talk and drink, until they were on the warm wave, drifting away from it all. Tom would drink until he was speechless and could only gesture, and then even his hands would be still. Outside it was almost dark. He made his way along the path by the murmuring river and up by the waterfall's roar. Then he stopped. He couldn't leave him like that. Say he brought him back to his mother's for an hour. He could see it through Tom's eyes, helping with the shopping, an old woman who was taking him home. Home, a place where a fire was kept alight always, a place where you could be tender, off guard. She would sit him at the fire, built up before Mass and burning bright now. No, he wouldn't take an egg. Would he like tea and a boiled egg? How did he like it? And the face, hardened by years in foreign teacher compounds, by mean jobs and cheap fares, would open into a boy's smile and say, "Just getting firm, thanks." He would look up at her as she poured the tea, look at everything, the holy pictures and photos on the mantelpiece. The pink knitted tea cosy, the striped knitted tea cosy. The pink knitted egg cosy, and the striped knitted tea cosy. I have to get these things right. The small buttered slice of homemade bread, the little knife with the black, little knife with the blackened bone handle, and the teaspoon she had taken from the Great Southern Hotel. Like a stranger in a foreign land. He couldn't. If he did that, Tom would never go. He couldn't, any more than he could go with his mother to Mass. He went on walking up the muddy path, startled the heron rose from the shadows, flapping its big, grey, silent wings, its long legs trailing as if broken, giving its cranking cry as it glided through the yellow light spilling from the pub windows and dropped out of sight again. As suddenly he saw the evening ahead, leaving his mother at the gate, sitting for a minute in the car until she was inside, and then driving away. As he went, he gathered dead sticks, a withered bough of ivy, that would burn with sweet smoke for her that night.
Oscar Wilde, told someone he apologised for writing a long letter as he hadn't time to write a short one. And what I love about this book is it's just of almost 7 decades of living. Put together in a really small number of 128 pages of beautiful crafted stories, going from the four stories when you arrive in Portobello.
That's right.
And you're actually and you're just meeting people, and you're trying to get the piano into the house, and And what year was that? What year?
1980. Moved there.
And I mean, Portobello, the place of Portobello becomes a character in the book as well, and the changing face and the changing ways, and the way Dublin changes. Although the stories go off and they go backwards in time before that, there's a wonderful setting being in a Protestant boarding school.
That's right, down in the county of
Westmeath. But it keeps coming back, and slowly the actual central character ages and slowly sort of grows from being a young man to being not so young a man.
Yeah, and he stops running away, and he realises that, for better or worse, this is his home. And he used to think home was somewhere else. He'd run off to America or England, but the constant coming back made, like a dog going round in circles in the grass, it wore a space which became home, and even the running away became somehow something that was brought back. So he ends up, as I have ended up, living in this one place for now nearly 33 years.
Because you've written novels and you've written travel and you've written memoirs, and was your sense of the writing this book was the book that sort of made sense of that whole, because there's almost a sense of a writer's life being summed up in this book.
I think it's only when you finish something like that, I mean, those stories are written over the years, but when you come to the last one, you see there's a pattern, and you do see a shape appear in your life. I think we all feel, even at our most wretched, that there's something almost fitting about the shape of our life. I hope that's not too cozy.
It captures like a lower middle class sort of background of 1950s and 60s Dublin. Do you feel that world, because I don't think that anybody captures that world so well as you do. Do you think that world has never really had a space in that sort of world, because it doesn't have pyrotechnics, because it doesn't have... You have a line, there's some story here where, the wild boy on the farm sells the cattle and goes to England, and the working class fella goes to jail, and the
middle class boy has a nervous breakdown.
and everything is done very, very quietly.
Yeah.
And do you feel that world hasn't ever really been properly written about? Or?
Well, our family was strange in that my parents came from the west of Ireland, from very small farms, and my father came to Dublin and set up a business, a shoe business, and we were sort of propelled. A bit like a plane taking off. You just felt you were moving from one world to another in the space of my own childhood. So from being... my father didn't even go to secondary school, never mind. You know, he hardly went to national school even. I think he left when he was about 12. And I was sent to a Jesuit school, which was a bourgeois place. So we were sort of lower middle class moving... are being pushed into the middle class, and it was, I described in one of my books, it was a bit like going up in a lift. as well. You know, there were different floors and you weren't sure which one to get out at, you know.
Because there's a sense of that as a story's change of your family being in there, from the outside being absolutely part of it, and at the same time little subtle nuances of caste and things like that.
Yeah,
you weren't didn't quite belong there in some people's eyes, and other people's eyes you didn't, depending. And a whole like flow of sort of a very, very class conscious world in terms of and not just one or two classes, but like 15 and 16 different types of castes and castes all walking.
It's a strange idea.
Together.
I mean, I think there is some truth in the famous remark that there's no class system in Ireland. I suppose compared with England, it's certainly not as rigid, but in other ways it's far more rigid, because in the country even, I mean, the idea of the boy in the yard marrying the farmer's daughter was absolutely unheard of. You know, there were strict layers of life, and that the man who had the grocery shop in town, you know, wasn't having anything to do with the next step down. Whereas I think in England there probably was a little bit more mixing of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
And in the writing, I remember the first book of yours I read was a very thick novel, the Feast of Michaelmas. and this is very, very similar. And has there been a sense almost of almost like a deliberate stripping away of everything that might be false, of everything not false, but everything that might be
well, you're very kind to say that term.
that might be extraneous, of really just because all these stories are actually very, very stripped down. They're very bare sort of stories, and they resonate with truth. I love the story of the old Jewish
trader
who calls in because he's been attacked in his home,
yeah,
and he calls all those neighbours are very, very real sort of people,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Well, I have a theory, maybe you can help me with it, that when you're young, you're able to write novels because your life is full of emotion, and mm-hmm. you're really almost, half of your life is based on emotion, mm-hmm. and you're falling in love and full of energy. But as you get older, that emotion dies down, and you're really working more and more out of your mind and your memory, I think, as you get older, and possibly that helps the stripping down.
So it's almost as if you're coming to experience the same experience twice. Once when you're living it,
yeah,
and then once suddenly when it sort of makes sense to you, like 15, 20 years later.
And maybe in that way you do tend to thin it down and mm-hmm. Focus it more sharply. I hope it's not just a sign of impotence and old age.
And I've
lost my bus pass. I couldn't get
Have you lost your bus pass?
Yeah,
you've lost it. Has it been taken away by the troika, or have you just changed jackets?
No, it hasn't been... It hasn't been reclaimed. No, it fell out of my pocket. In the bank, appropriately.
Yeah. Well, it has probably been sold.
It probably has.
Do you think that there's a lot to be said for the short book? Do you think that...
Looking
back on all the books, do you feel that this is, in some ways, if you can distill it down to this, that it's more memorable than the great epic book?
I think I don't have that confidence to create characters, so I end up writing about myself and things and people I know. But unfortunately, as you get older, you get nicer and you don't like to hurt people's feelings. So my range of powers is narrowing, yeah.
Although did the memoir The Family Business cause?
That caused a lot of trouble.
That was quite a very sharp analysis of social class and so at the same time, like, this is a very nice man, and this is a very nice book. But like there is, but it is full of home truths.
Yeah, but I didn't make any enemies out of that book, which is a blessed relief.
But talk about the generation of writers that you were from, because in the family.
Business.
But there are very veiled portraits of like Paul Dawkin and of Brian Lynch and of many other sort of writers that are there. And was that a fascinating time in Irish writing when there was...
It was to me, the nicest thing about that world was that I had gone to a school where it was expected you'd become a lawyer or a Jesuit or a doctor. And I didn't want to be any of those things. So I ended up becoming a school teacher, but I was no good as a school teacher because... As soon as I came into class, the children who had been quiet until then began laughing. And the next thing is the headmaster came down to see what was wrong. And one day I was brought to the school psychiatrist to see what my problem was. So I had to leave that. And then to find there was a world, you know, I was drifting towards writing, to find there were people who were in the same boat. And people are, you know, people have more in common than they have apart. And, mm-hmm. You know, everyone comes from a family and everyone wants to try and please their parents. And, you know, everyone is embarrassed, you know, before their father. You're not earning any money. You're doing one book review every fortnight for the Irish Press.
Was it very hard in the sense of your father left school, so really you're moving, and then suddenly to really, there's almost like a very quiet defiance. I mean, other people went to India and grew their hair long and sort of contracted nefarious diseases, and you wrote books. And was this your own?
He was very encouraging. He called me one day and said, "I'll give you an allowance as long as you need." So. Mm-hmm. That was kind. I got £5 a week, which was great. So I was able to pay. I was living in the Brazen Head, which cost £3.10 a week for bed and the use of the kitchen. God help us. So, no, it was just, as you know yourself, as I'm sure the audience know, it's kindness is what makes it more embarrassing if you don't do well. I mean, if your father's horrible, you don't really give a damn how you do, you know, how he feels. But if he's nice to you, you want to please him, yeah.
So. And the book is full of vanished walls, and that vanished wall of the Bowdoin School. Can you tell us about the experience of being a teacher in a Bowdoin School? In that sort of, I mean, there are still Bowdoin schools, but not in that sort of totally closeted sort of, you know, cut off way.
I went as soon as I left UCD. I went to America, but I couldn't take it, so I had a nervous breakdown and came home. At least that's my explanation of it. Anyway, and then I got... There's my daughter laughing. I recognise that. And then I got... I wanted to go somewhere that I... You know, there was absolutely no trouble where, you know, America in 1968 was mad. You know, Martin Luther King was shot while I was there. I was in Tennessee, and then Bobby Kennedy was shot, and Woodstock, and the dope, and the shootings on the campus, and the Vietnam riots, and... It was more than I could take. So I went down to County Westmeath, and I'd had enough of the Catholic Church as well for the time being. So I went to a Protestant school, very poor little school. And the boys, you know, had to march in crocodiles in their gabardine coats and boots and caps up and down the country roads. And I was trying to keep them from running over the ditches. They'd try and steal carrots out of the field. You know, they were hungry even. And that I stuck that for 2 or 3 years. And it was calming, and it was great to get away from Dublin. But after that, I came back to Dublin and tried to write then. It's like everything, you know, it's like everything else. Unless you're really stupid, or unless you really lack a sense of rhythm, if you work at something hard, like writing, you'll probably get somewhere, you know. It stands to reason, if you...
Almost this feels like, almost like a life's work completed, but presumably it's not. Presumably... Is there a new book in progress?
I'm trying to do one, but I'm struggling against my innate niceness or timidity now, and you can't really be a good writer if you're worried about what everyone is saying. You just can't. Mm-hmm. And you can't be worried about what the critics say either. Mm-hmm. You just have to do what you can do as best you can. And if that hurts people's feelings, it's awful, but sometimes it has to happen.
You read that story about your mother. And her journey as well is very, very fascinating in the book of the way that she gradually blends in, and also her, although she keeps her faith and everything else, but her world changes. And after
does,
your father dies,
yeah.
And so she begins to take on another life.
Well, people do. I was talking to the butcher in Campbell Street the other day, and he said, if I told my father now that this morning I've served people from about 17 countries, mm-hmm. he wouldn't believe. And he said, yet everything is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Your mother goes mad when you say... My mother went mad when I said I wasn't going to Mass, and then she wept for about a month, I think. And then, you know, it's like if you tell someone, your mother, that you're homosexual, they probably weep. And then after a few months or years, they're warmer towards you than ever. So it's what life is like. Life tends to grow upwards, not downwards, and it grows towards the light. And the light is life.
Yeah, so. That's true. Adrian Kenny.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Redline Readings, a Curious broadcast production in partnership with South Dublin Libraries. Redline Readings was part of South Dublin Library's Redline Book Festival and was curated by writer Dermot Bulger. On this programme you heard Dermot in conversation with Adrian Kenny, who read from his book Portobello Notebook. You can podcast this programme on www.southdublinlibraries.com and on www.curiousbroadcast.com. Redline Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a broadcasting authority of Ireland fund.